whatever they were talking about and whomever they were talking about went a long way back.
Why? With Arcia Tecún. Malolana, kia ora. I'll let you introduce yourself. I know you've been on before, but you have gone through a lot of changes since the last time we did this. And so I'll turn it to you to share what you've been kind of getting up to and where you're at now.
My name is Lana Lopesi. The main difference is now we're both on this side of the Pacific Ocean. So I am in Oregon, Eugene, Oregon, and I work at the university here in the Department of Indigenous Race and Ethnic Studies as an assistant professor, and doing the same kind of work that I've always done, but I suppose it's a shift doing it in the US context and within an ethnic studies context, which is something we don't have in New Zealand, but also working out what that means from a Pacific studies context. And then I teach across my areas of Pacific studies, but also Indigenous feminism, global indigeneities, and contemporary art.
So you mentioned something, I was like, oh man, we should unpack that just a little bit, because that context shift, I know we've talked about it a bit in the past, and the way I've been thinking about it now is, I feel like, you know, the last project we did together along with Anisha and several others was trying to explore race in the context of Aotearoa New Zealand, because often the politic there is, I would say, overdetermined by indigeneity and didn't have a grammar of race, as we collectively argued. But here, I feel like it's inverted, and it's the politic, I feel, is overdetermined by race, and indigeneity enters this realm of like invisibility. There isn't a robust grammar of indigeneity. So I just want to see what are your thoughts on that? What do you observe in the shift of context?
Yeah, I think that's like exactly how I have found it too. I would say back home, what I was really craving was these conversations to talk about race, but also to talk about gender in particular ways, and then how those things intersect. And, you know, just reading so much scholarship coming from the US that gave me language. But what I didn't realize was that the sort of foundation of colonialism and then indigeneity in relation to that was sort of the groundwork for New Zealand context to then build this conversation of race. And I think I come here and I realize that Native folks are just not really a part of that conversation, because the racial grammar seems to be the one that is the first priority. And so, and then I guess sort of like DEI and kind of like civil rights conversations based off of a race as this really prominent and present organizing structure. And so, yeah, just kind of like, in a way, the inverse. And I feel like I really noticed this when I went home quickly. I think it would have been this time last year, April last year. And it was for a like New Zealand Order of Merit thing. So this very kind of Commonwealth style celebration. But within that, it starts with a karanga, and then there's a karakia, and then the national anthem sung in Te Reo Māori first. And I think just that real quick like flip from the US into that context, realizing like, hey, I don't hear Native language anywhere. I don't see Native presence outside of the kind of professional scholarly spaces that I'm choosing to be in, just in kind of like the general everyday. It feels so absent in comparison to, you know, everyone has at least like 5 Te Reo Māori words that they know, and kids kind of go through that in primary school in a different way. So there's just like a depth of understanding, but I feel like you need both of them simultaneously. And so it's just sort of like opposite problems. I don't know which is, I don't think any is like better or worse, but it's just really interesting to me how these organizing structures become so present, and then other things sort of fall away.
No, that's awesome. Well, we're going to get into gender in a little bit, because I think that's the other one, right? It's like this and, right? Rather than or. And I think that's the we're moving towards, but just observing those shift of priorities or perhaps design in society.
I think as well, you know, back home, it's like Māori and everyone else. And I think, you know, that's, I would say, like, because of the foundation of the treaty. Whereas here, it feels like the group that takes that priority are African Americans because of their particular history with chattel slavery. And so I think blackness has a visibility that therefore then introduces this conversation around race. Whereas it's just that I think Indigenous folks don't have that that status that we do with like the bicultural nation in New
Yeah.
Zealand. So yeah, it's just interesting.
So as you mentioned that, all right, I'm going to throw this out because I think that's something I've been thinking a lot more about in my return. So even though being raised here after, as long as I was in Aotearoa and then back, it's just kind of like on that note, like with the limits that Te Tiriti o Waitangi may have even internally within Māoridom, like it is this kind of central organizing document that has this national level pragmatism. And here it's just like the amount of federally recognized tribes is fluctuating on an annual basis. And then each have their own treaty, and then each have their own governance structure in relation to the nation state. And so then, like the civil rights component that, Black folks led and has benefited so many people in that realm, they were also forced into the civil, I think, domain, which is where it's visible. And like, you have all these different treaties. So there is, it doesn't have that same kind of centralizing national, or at least practicality at a national level. And then it operates kind of outside of the civil rights frame, even like in a legal structure. So I just throwing that out because I was like, oh yeah. Like, the other thing I wanted to ask, that we did bring this up last time we had you on, it was, you're coming out with Monocosmopolitan, and that was one of the, top interests on this pod. I know this small kind podcast, but that one put me on there because there's a lot of interest there, along with Dabaism and a few other things. And so at that time we did talk about terms a little bit. And so before we get into the roots of feminism and gender, I wanted to just kind of revisit that briefly and to see what you're thinking now in terms of like the terms that we want to use and that I think we use, but at the same time negotiating a different context that is like in some ways adopting Pacifica, often pronounced Pacifica, in this context, but also coming out of the Pacific Island framework, which is again very different from the way it's being talked about. And then that's different from even using like Moana or Tasi or Wansawatā or Marae or what have you. So I wanted to give you a chance to just speak to terms a little bit, and then we'll get into the other stuff.
Oh my gosh, I can't wait for this conversation to be over. In part because I feel like, in New Zealand we just don't say poly. Like we have hangovers like Polyfest, but I feel like the conversation here about terms is just like so different. Whereas Pasifika was coming in with the Ministry of Education in the 1970s, and so we're still there, but I think there's different terms. It's just in a different place, I suppose. And so I feel like here now it's all of those conversations that I imagine folks were having then with the conversations that we've been having. And so there's like seems to be even more terms out there. And I think where I am with it now, and then even the word islander, like, we use that in New Zealand, but other people don't. And so hearing people kind of use Pacific Islander in this like official way, like even that's been a bit of a culture shock. But yeah, I think where I'm at is again still just like these are all terms of convenience, and they all have their issues. And I feel like the more terms we're able to use that are specific to our own positionalities and worldviews, the better. And I think there's a kind of importance in owning where those terms come from too, and owning your choices in those. So I still use one in my own work, but I also use like everything else at the same time. I don't know if that's like a satisfactory answer, but I think it's like the realness, the messiness of it.
Yeah, no, fair enough. I surrender to practicality sometimes as well. So I use the terms that I want, but then I'll also like appendage it with what I know the local setting is familiar with as a pathway to it. So I'll use stuff interchangeably.
I think that's the thing too, in New Zealand scale is so different. And so there is a visibility and a legibility in a way that there is not in the continental US. And so you do have to use terms that people recognize as a way to then be able to talk about the specifics of things, but there's just a different, it's just a different context.
Let's start getting into gender feminism a little bit, because this is one of the things that you've done a lot of work on. I mean, Bloody Women, for me, I really appreciate and enjoyed that book. And I know for others it was very impactful also. And so, but in general, like, I guess in the shift of conversation, there's also like thinking about feminism. And what, I guess for you, what have you observed in terms of the different contexts? And perhaps maybe start with how you understand it or use it or define it, and how you see that shifting across the context that you've just moved across.
Yeah, I think similarly to the discussions, the discourse on race that exists out of the US that I was reading in New Zealand, I felt really inspired by the work of Black, Indigenous, and women of color feminists who were using that word feminism in like a non-ironic, non-apologetic way, but that actually being a discourse that was established from the 1970s and has expanded out and has like all of these many different facets to it. And then in the context of New Zealand at that time, I felt like there's a lot of work on gender, and people use that word. But in terms of scholarly work where folks were actively calling themselves feminists, I think that is less so. It was more, my interpretation of the conversation was focused on like justifying feminism on the one hand, and then the critique being that feminism being a thing from over there that we don't need. Similar in a way, I suppose, to like racial discourse being a problem over there that we don't need in New Zealand. And so shifting here, then I think it's the complete opposite. And what I really realized is that feminism as a like intellectual endeavor by Black, Indigenous, and women of color feminists really happened in the university. And so I think there's like this class element to these conversations around feminism. And I see that a lot with my students who come in. One of my classes is required for our Native American Indigenous Studies major and minor. And so a lot of them will come in, Native students, being like, I don't need feminism. That's an over there thing. And what I try to say is like, there are waves of feminism. There's this kind of white stream, mainstream way that we think about feminism. But what we're talking about here in the context of Indigenous feminism, it's a completely different door. It's like, it's a return to Indigenous worldviews that saw gender in a completely different way. And even within that, it's so dependent on the Indigenous worldview, what that kind of feminism would look like. And so that's kind of the main thing, is that I feel like for me, I'm interested in a feminism that engages with systems and structures of power as they exist now, but also looks back to things in my context in a Samoan worldview that might have been or that have shifted over time. And then on the other side of that, it's having like a real honest and difficult look at the way in which gender shifted through colonial processes, how a lot of the things that we have now are not our own, and how we have like significant numbers of folks who go through things like domestic violence, intimate partner violence, sexual violence, and sort of where those things come from. Also, like income disparity, and why it is, you know, that women, Pacific women, engage so much in care work. All of these things kind of woven together in this complicated way. That's sort of the realm of feminism that I'm interested in.
So I'm thinking about one of the terms that I'm familiar with in terms of Indigenous feminism, like the regenerative refusals. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that in terms of like the appendage that's added, right? Like, so there's feminism, but then there's also like, okay, which kind of feminism? And I guess I would see that as kind of a refusal of saying, oh, ours is different, or this is different than that. And what I'm thinking of is, I recently was rereading some of Jody Bird's work, and they had made this argument that, you know, like the queer and queer studies is not the same as the queer and indigenous studies. And one of the main contentions was, I guess, the way you position power. And in that context, it was like, all right, how do you contend with the colonial force in relation to that particular discourse? So just wondering what, yeah, I guess your thoughts are in terms of the direction you're going and thinking about with indigenous feminisms.
Yeah, and you know, Bird in that article talks about the cognitive dissonance that exists between sort of queer studies and indigenous studies, and how my interpretation of it is like how sort of something happens or doesn't happen or goes past each other in those two spheres too. And I feel like that happens too in terms of indigenous studies and like gender studies or feminist studies. But what I would say is, as well, is that a lot of people have been working in this area for a really long time. So it is like a pretty old scholarly legacy. And I think it's really hard to reckon with because I think it's so personal in some ways too. Like it's a lot of kind of personal work about how to deal with those modes of power. But I suppose the other thing too is in the Pacific context is, you know, in my Samoan context, that's really all I can speak to. You have a place that is majority indigenous population, like most people speak Samoan language, have gone through formal decolonization and have their own like independent government. And so that is kind of often used as like an argument to not need feminism because it's like, oh, we don't need that thing because, you know, we're sovereign. And so that's when people like Maria Lugones' work becomes really important in terms of thinking about coloniality and the way in which through Christianity and through that decolonization process, Western ideas were embedded within Wha Samoa to the point now where it's constitutionally Christian and the country's motto is, you know, places Christianity right at the forefront of cultural values. And so it's like you can't tell me that gender didn't shift somewhere between when we had when we, you know, think about Ngāwhānawa as our god of war and these very powerful political figures like Saula Messina to today, and the kind of disparities that we see around women represented in various kind of political systems, to the realities for Samoan women in diaspora, where all of this then compounds with the realities of being within a Western heteropatriarchal society. So somewhere in that history, the power shifts. There have always been gender roles in Indigenous communities and in Indigenous Samoan communities. The difference is that power was balanced, right? The places in which power were held that I kind of digged into in Bloody Woman, in terms of the value placed on the womb, the importance placed on the reproductive body because they reproduce the genealogies. That kind of shifted to meld with like Western ideas of the reproductive body, in which there is shame, in which kind of men are seen as having this exalted status. And so I think there's it's sort of somewhere in those shifts of power that we need to spend a bit more time. But I think that's a really mucky process because we can't ever go back. You know, like Albert Wentz said, there is no utopian womb to return to. All we have is these sort of these signs, these stories, the memories, I suppose, little kind of like traces of evidence, if we want to kind of call it that. And so then that's where I think the work of like regenerative refusal, as folks like Miley Arvin and Leanne Simpson write about it, becomes really important because it's not about returning back, but kind of the idea of like regenerating, creating something new based on what we have. And so that's where I feel like the space for feminism is that kind of like world building, which doesn't lose sight of the criticality that is needed, but is also not sort of caught up in this like reproduction of romanticized ideas that actually contribute to significant portions of our indigenous populations, like, you know, not having full access to what could be like a really great life.
Oh man, it's making me so many things thinking about. One of those is time, right? Like for me, what you're doing is you're playing with time and you're juxtaposing all these different things of like you can't go back, but at the same time, that memory in the present offers a tension with the present in doing something else right now, which is in essence doing the future now, in one way of thinking about it. And thinking about power is so fascinating too, because it's not to say that there wasn't like power dynamics either in the past. They just weren't organized around gender in the way that they are right now, right? Like,
And I
go.
think that's a really important thing because when we hold on to these values of collectivism and community, and those are very important, but we also have very stratified hierarchical societies. So there was power and there was political power, but that was not based on gender, like you said. It was based on your lineage. And so women played a part in that. And so it's about how through those colonial processes, when people preferred to talk to men and men saw that they could suddenly have this additional power that they didn't have otherwise. And we see that in indigenous societies across the globe, how that then shifted, or how sort of gender became embedded within these indigenous power systems that were otherwise organized differently.
Yeah. So now you open up to something else, and maybe we'll get into a little bit of trouble, but let's go for it. Because with that example you just gave, right? I think this applies, in the example you gave of men realizing that they could leverage something in the kind of geopolitical moment of kind of global empire. That to me resonates with so many issues of power in our current setting around gender and race and indigeneity. And like I think about there has been more of it, and but it hasn't been, I would say, at least for me, the most robust of like if we actually focus on our realms, which are marginal in the modern world, but if we're focused on our realms, then like it could be marginal to that, but in our realm, like we have layers of marginality too, and there's also elite practices. And I think about a conversation I had around the like because sometimes there's a strategic romanticizing, which I'm not, throwing shade at. Like there's a place for it and there's a moment for it, but sometimes I feel like it will overlook that maybe not even just a complicitness in agency to this new form of power, but an active participation at different moments. Whether it's men seeing that they can now leverage this new opportunity of power, or whether it's certain indigenous groups that through allyship with empire, because this is my stance, but I feel like I don't think it's possible without local help. And at least in all the examples I've looked at, and I think there's this the racialized myth of superiority is reinforced in my view when it's like, oh yeah, superior technology, strategy, whatever. I was like, I don't buy it. In every context that I'm familiar with, it took local help. And there's layers of that. So I think that's what's kind of coming up to mind when you share that example. Because I think if we're focusing on us and we're having a conversation with us, it allows us to move away from having to react or respond to the white gaze or even the patriarchal gaze and say, all right, what's the conversation like with us and what we've brought in of those things? And having, I guess, a hard conversation of like, active participation in making the world that we know, even though we're against it, and like how we inherit that, and also how do we take that into account when we are exerting our, I guess, whatever limits of agency we have at the moment. I don't know if any of that makes sense. That's just what you made me think of, and I'm going to throw it back to you and see what you think.
Well, I think if I'm interpreting what you're saying correctly, that's kind of a long-standing conversation within these like feminist conversations that exist within communities. Like Kate Shanley, I think it was like 1981, asked like, does me being a feminist make me less Indian now in terms of like the critiques that were leveraged at her from within community because she was raising these issues that existed within her community. And sort of, it's sort of like, I've seen this conversation happen in lots of different ways, but it's like, why are you raising that? Like, we've got this collective fight. We can't kind of reveal the things that exist inside just yet. And, Audre Lorde talked about it a lot too within the within the movements that she was a part of, sort of like, why are you separating out Black women when we should all be working together? And of course, it was like the men that were saying these things. So I think there's like a contention that has to happen within communities where you're really examining, like, are we actually doing the things that we're doing? And in that sense, for everyone, you know, always looking at those who have less power than you or who are impacted by these various structures in different ways, whether that be, you know, ability, sexuality, class, et cetera, et cetera. But it kind of makes me think about In Bloody Women, sort of as I was doing my PhD within the Vamwana cluster, and we were really thinking about this idea of VAR, right? So like relationality and reciprocity and the relational spaces that we all exist within. And we talk about this and it sounds really beautiful, but what we don't talk about is the systems of power or the structures of power that we bring in to the VAR, even as Pacific people engaging with each other. And so it's like, yeah, we're saying we're doing this thing, but are we really? Like, who's really at this table right now? Who's missing? And I feel like it's those conversations that we need to have. And in terms of like leveraging political power for the group, there's just strength in numbers, right? So like to be being like aware of these things that impact people in different ways, I would say just would give you more numbers to like engage in whatever struggle you're wanting to. But if you refuse to do that, you probably at some point will alienate yourself from the rest of the group because you're not, you know, aware of the power and the privilege that you do have. And so I feel like feminism is just one lens to think through that, that has been useful for me and thinking about my own experience. So yeah, it's sort of like the lateral violences that can occur within communities and the constant ways we need to check ourselves about how that is happening. And it's a tough one.
Where would you say the current state is in terms of those kind of, I guess, those different contexts of the various communities that exist beyond and outside of access to or working through the university structure, and at the same time, the importance of like what the university structure may support in terms of setting apart people with time and space to invest in thinking through language and the phenomenon in community.
I think, you know, university gives us the luxury to sit around in class and think through these ideas and read. You know, that's a student's job is to read and think for 4 years. And so it gives us a chance to really like think through these ideas, but also like the histories. Like that's like a big part of what I walk through with students is the fact that this has been like this is an ideology, but it's been legislated and it's been embedded. And whether we're talking about sterilization or blood quantum or, you know, Roe v. Wade, there it's like a continual history that impacts people's lives every day. And so we get to just sit there and look at that and look at it from all of these different angles. And it's tough. Like it's probably the toughest class that I teach. I had to bring in like a journaling assignment so that I didn't just dump my students with this really heavy material and be like, goodbye, have a good day. So like they really like do the work. But that's such a privileged space to be in as well, which is not to say that it's easy for them, but not everyone gets to have the space to think about these things. So I feel like university is a really unique place and that it can get ideas flowing. It also helps them see like their own families in a different way and to kind of realize that like, oh, I actually do come from this long line of feminists, but maybe they prefer the word matriarchs or their own kind of language term for it. So I think it does really important work in that vein. It also does work important work where, you know, folks like us give language to things that we see and are able to think about these things in really serious ways. But the actual change happens in community. So I think that on the one hand, I would hope that with my students, there's some kind of trickle-down impact. I know a lot of my students, we do a lot of like letter writing, and they'll give a lot of those letters to their family members and then start those conversations within their family. And like that's like I feel like the biggest thing I can hope for as a professor in those classes. But really, it's about the kind of practices of like rematriation that they might be engaging in, or them doing their own self-work in terms of working through shame that they hold for various reasons, men and women, and all of those not on the gender binary, or whatever that work looks like in that in their community context. Yeah, I feel like that's where change happens. So what I say to my students is I feel like stuff has to be everywhere all at the same time. It can't be one or the other. And I think, again, talking about power, it's seeing none of these spaces as more or less powerful, but just the university rescaling it back to just kind of one space within a wider range. I also think, a lot of early kind of feminist of color literature was more, it was written in more popular forms, in more personal forms, like essays. And that's really how that work got out there to reach like these wider audiences. There's probably versions of that today, which would be maybe more like Instagram tiles or like TikTok kind of mini lecture chat. But I do think it exists in this like populist sphere too, which has a different impact. But yeah, I don't know. I think it's everywhere all at once. So I think there's always going to be that gap, I would say, between like the university and the real world. And I can only contribute like my part, but I can see other community folks and organizations doing their part, which is possibly more important because I then teach about what they're doing in the classroom and pair it with the literature.
I want to ask one more thing, and that one more thing could have a follow-up. We'll see. But because of what you've shared, and again, I did want to kind of, if you're okay with it, revisiting some of, at least for me, one of the really big takeaways for me from your book, Bloody Woman, was the idea of tautalaiti. And correct me or if I'm wrong, but I just kept thinking trickster. And like, I know there's like this cheekiness to it, but like, for me, it's kind of like what you mentioned as well, like, kind of this the cheekiness is because there's a refusal even in the context that one's in, and there's like this challenge, it's like this revelatory moment. And I don't know, I just wondering if you're willing to share a little bit about that and kind of where you see that in the role that you see within like feminism and the way you're approaching it.
Yeah, I was really interested in kokolekiki as like a cultural value and trying to assert that alongside, palolo, respect and alofa, love and service and these really kind of noble, I suppose, characteristics that are foundational to Samoan culture. I'm not denying that, but I was sort of like, what about jealousy and cheekiness and like all of these other things that are also, I would say, like key cultural values, if we can call them that. And so I suppose to kind of build on onto the, or to give a bit of backstory, I was also really interested in how morality and this pressure to be like a good Samoan daughter or girl or whatever it might be, good Samoan families, the sort of introduction of the Christian nuclear family, how all of that was used as a disciplining tool, and how being called kokolekiki was like the worst thing in the world. For me anyway, growing up. And the more sort of Samoans I talk to about that and about the book, I think it's safe to say that's a shared cultural sentiment. But why is it that cheekiness is sort of the worst thing that you can be called? And how is it that it can be used as like a mode of disciplining? And then on the flip side, how it can also be used as a way to leverage like various modes of power. And what I was sort of thinking about with that term too is I feel like that never stops being used against women, even like elder women, whereas men seem to be able to grow out of it. Like it becomes funny at some point and not a negative thing, whereas it's not the same, I would say. Or yeah, it's not equal. And so how then when you relook at other contexts and you kind of reframe your idea of kokolekiki not as just as like a bad thing, but actually as like a way of asserting power within a limited situation, how that then shifts everything else. And so thinking about the like Native informants and Margaret Mead's work, how maybe they them sort of like telling these stories as Jared Freeman, I Guess Happens, wasn't just them lying, but was actually them kind of leveraging some power and therefore like protecting their own subjectivity, because we don't know. We don't know what that was like. You know, we have a perception of it through Mead's work, but how it actually happened, you know, who knows? And so like when you look at that, it is, it's kind of funny. Like there is like this trickster element. It gives the power back to people who really otherwise, you know, don't have much power. And so I guess it's something that I've kind of held on to and I've really enjoyed thinking with. I haven't been able to develop it much more yet, but I am interested in thinking about it as like a methodology. Like what would that look like in as applied to scholarly work as a methodology? I think that would be really interesting to play around with.
I'm excited for that. I do have a follow-up because you brought up morality. And so I just wanted to dig a little bit more there because I think, you know, often it's weaponized in a gendered way. There's a different constellation of possibilities to interpret behavior or results that are not premised primarily around that. And I think about like other concepts like mana and tapu, and the relation to Noah or Mofua, like I don't know, those are just kind of the things that have come to mind in terms of previous examples of conversations and thought, but wanted to know what do you think, or how do you see, I guess, that larger metaphysics of morality along the lines of indigeneity and feminism?
Well, I think, you know, like morality as it exists in society today, we're really talking about Christian morality and, you know, that those ethics in terms of what is like good or bad, or even those ideas of goodness and badness. And so I think it's about, on the one hand, like understanding how deeply embedded those are. And actually that's been a lot of the work that I've had to do through my own work, being like, oh, why do I think this way? Or like, why does that feel like that's the norm? And so I guess it's like that is the organizing structure, right? But there are always been organizing structures. So I think, like you say, mana and tapu, it's like a form of that. Maybe it's like a form of legislation in a different kind, whereas like, you know, which is quite different to the form of legislation that we have today. But I think it's also about rescaling what now feels like the general global way of thinking about goodness and badness into just one worldview. And so I'm really interested in like digging a bit more into like what promiscuity means within that context too, like not just in terms of sexual promiscuity, but that as well, but just in terms of like being able to move through multiple worldviews and multiple ideas. Like, why do we hold so intensely on to societal norms? I think it's really interesting when we think about Indigenous studies and conversations around decolonization, because I think these same ideas of morality also become subsumed into these conversations. So I think it's just about having the ability to pick into that a little bit more, and yeah, not being afraid of ideas like promiscuity. And I suppose that's where the feminist lens comes in too, because it gives me a way to think through these ideas and to sort of, you know, think about the like not just the disciplining through the idea of Kopolekiki, but also, you know, like the witch trials, the kind of multiple ways in which like different bodies have been disciplined over time through these ideas of morality that come from somewhere, you know, and then sort of have this universalizing force. And I think that there's a lot of work for us to do in like Pacific communities around morality too.
I don't want to follow up with that. So, Papatai, Kia ora, Lana. Thank you so much. Appreciate you being on.
Oh, thank you.